This is Audible.
Audible Inc. presents A Land So Strange, The Epic Journey of Cabeza de Vaca. Written by Andres Resendez. Narrated by Jonathan Davis. Maps found in the print edition of this book are available to you as a downloadable PDF. To access this file, please click on the link on the product page where you purchased this title. Thank you.
Introduction. In the spring of 1536, a posse of European horsemen ventured north from Culiacán. Barely one generation after Columbus, they were, quite literally, the advancing edge of Spain's empire in North America. They were still becoming familiar with this region, now part of northwestern Mexico. The riders could gaze at the lush slopes of the Sierra Madre Occidental on the right. The Pacific Ocean, with its loud crashing waves, lay to the left. Straight ahead, a narrow coastal plain seemed to extend forever. On this strip of land, at once tropical and open, they could roam as far as they wished, without ever expecting to find another white person. Only Indian prey. The horsemen were busy. Rounding up human beings was unpleasant, but profitable. And they looked to an entire continent teeming with natives who could not move faster than their own legs would carry them. Even a small cavalry detachment could turn into an extremely efficient enslaving machine. And thus the posse burned villages and ran down men, women, and children. One day, four of the slavers caught sight of 13 Indians walking barefoot and clad in skins. In the distance, the natives must have seemed ordinary to the horsemen, except for one thing. Rather than scurrying away, the Indians headed straight toward them. A sense of unease must have spread through the Christians. But they stayed put, because the approaching Indians did not seem to harbor ill intentions. At closer range, the unexpected details began to emerge. One of the natives seemed very dark. In fact, he was black. Was he an Indian too, or an African emerging from the depths of North America? The horsemen's unease must have turned into shock when they realized that one of the others in the group was a white man. He had gone completely native. His hair hung down to his waist, and his beard reached to his chest. The man's skin was leathery and peeling. As the two parties approached, the slavers could hear that the haggard white man spoke perfect Spanish. They became dumbfounded. They remained looking at me for a long time, Alvar Núñez Cabeza de Vaca would later recall, so astonished that they neither talked to me nor managed to ask me anything. Cabeza de Vaca had to do the talking. He first asked to be taken to the slaver's captain. Next, he wanted to know what the Christian date was and requested to have it officially recorded. The precise date has not reached us, in spite of Cabeza de Vaca's insistence, but it must have been April 1536. After these formalities were out of the way, Cabeza de Vaca and his African companion, a resilient slave named Estebanico, began to tell their story of wandering adrift in a completely alien continent. A tale that had begun 8 years earlier with a flawed leader in search of redemption. For sheer drama and excitement, the journey of Cabeza de Vaca and his companions remains unrivaled, even by the adventurous standards of the age of exploration. Out of 300 men who set out to colonize Florida in 1528, only four survived. Cabeza de Vaca, two other Spaniards, and Estebanico. They became stranded, and to re-enter European-controlled territory, they were forced into a harrowing passage on makeshift rafts across the Gulf of Mexico, years of captivity in what is now Texas, and a momentous walk across the continent all the way to the Pacific coast. This small band of men thus became the first outsiders to behold what would become the American Southwest and northern Mexico, the first non-natives to describe this enormous land and its peoples. Conversely, innumerable natives living in the interior of the continent experienced the passage of the three Spaniards and the African as an extraordinary portent, a first brush with the world beyond America. The natives called the four travelers the children of the sun because they seemed to have come from such unimaginably remote lands. It is tempting to narrate their journey as an extreme tale of survival. Four naked men at the mercy of the natural elements, facing an extraordinary array of native societies. Comparisons to Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness are difficult to avoid. It was certainly a hellish journey, but it was also much more. At its heart, it is the story of how a handful of survivalists, out of necessity, were able to bridge two worlds that had remained apart for 12,000 years or more. Deprived of firearms and armor, the castaways were forced to cope with North America on its own terms. They lived by their wits, mastering half a dozen native languages and making sense of social worlds that other Europeans could not even begin to fathom. Incredibly, they used their knowledge of native cultures to escape from enslavement and refashion themselves into medicine men. Eventually, their reputation as healers preceded them wherever they went, as they moved from one group to the next in their quest for deliverance. The castaways' insight into native North America is especially poignant at a time when Europeans debated whether the natives of America were fully human, and crown officials re-examined Spain's conquests. In just 5 decades since Columbus, Iberians had rushed headlong into the New World. Men and women of enterprise and ambition had explored and ultimately devastated the islands of the Caribbean. More recently, Hernán Cortés and Francisco Pizarro had subdued millions of Indians in Mexico and Peru. These conquests constituted fantastic feats of daring, but they had been achieved at a great human cost, prompting a determined group of friars and crown officials to launch a reformist movement to change Spain's methods of conquest and convince colonizers of the essential humanity of Indians. The ensuing debate resonated throughout the empire. If it turned out that Indians did not possess human souls, then ruthless conquistadors would be permitted to enslave them by the millions. But if, however, these natives were endowed with God's spirit, then they would have to be painstakingly Christianized and their rights respected. Against this backdrop, the journey of the four castaways constitutes a rare turning point in the history of North America, every bit as momentous and full of possibilities as the landing of the Mayflower Pilgrims or the arrival of Cortés on the shores of Mexico. The experience of Cabeza de Vaca and his companions afforded Spain an opportunity to consider a different kind of colonialism. These four pioneers had revealed the existence of many native cultures north of Mexico and the availability of precious metals, buffalo, and other resources. But instead of advocating a conquest in the traditional mold, Cabeza de Vaca and the others proposed a grand alliance with the native inhabitants. Over the course of their long odyssey, they had come to recognize the natives of North America as fellow human beings. Their life-changing experience had persuaded them that a humane colonization of North America was possible, a far cry from the views held by most of their contemporaries in the Old World. Their journey thus amounts to a fork in the path of exploration and conquest, a road that, if taken, could have transformed the brutal process by which Europeans overtook the land and riches of America. There was a time when the adventures of these four resilient travelers were well known in America and Europe. Two extraordinary texts made the castaway story available to anyone interested. One was the testimony provided by the three surviving Spaniards upon their return. This document is often referred to as the Joint Report. Although the original testimony was lost at some point, a near-complete transcription has survived until today, thanks to the assiduous work of fellow explorer and chronicler Gonzalo Fernández de Oviedo, 1478-1557, who included it as part of his massive Historia General y Natural de las Indias, Islas y Tierra Firme del Mar Océano. The second source is a first-person narrative written by Cabeza de Vaca and first published in 1542, 6 years after he completed his journey. Cabeza de Vaca's humble and self-reflective account circulated widely in the Spanish Empire and even beyond it. Contemporary explorers pored over the narrative, looking for even the most casual mention of metals, or simply to learn about the terrain and human landscape of the interior of North America. More pious readers drew transcendent lessons from this text, recasting the four survivors as Christ-like figures. A 17th-century friar, for instance, matter-of-factly stated that Cabeza de Vaca and his companions performed prodigies and miracles among innumerable barbarous nations and healed the Indians by making the sign of the cross over them. In either case, colonial Spaniards were well aware of this tale. More recently, however, the Odyssey of Cabeza de Vaca and the others has fallen into relative oblivion. In the United States, the Florida expedition has received surprisingly scant public attention, even though historians and archaeologists have passionately sparred over the survivors' probable routes across the continent for well over a century. These scholars have felt sufficiently motivated to venture into rugged lands and onto forgotten trails. A courageous writer even tried to fix Cabeza de Vaca's latitude by sleeping naked outdoors until he could not bear it any longer. Clearly, the Florida expedition has stirred powerful emotions among some enthusiasts and specialists. But beyond this circle, its impact has been modest. The Survivor's Saga is somewhat better known in Mexico. In the early 1990s, an entire generation of moviegoers went to see a film bearing the slightly disorienting title of Cabeza de Vaca, or Cow's Head. The film is mesmerizing, as much for the plot, the world of conquistadors turned upside down, as for the surreal atmosphere, complete mutual incomprehension in the midst of a magical world. Although the film takes considerable liberties with the facts, it played a crucial role in bringing the story to a wide audience. Nevertheless, Mexico's narrative of conquest is still dominated by the towering figure of Cortés and the downfall of the Aztec Empire. The Florida expedition remains something of a minor curiosity or a diversion. Modern boundaries have further obscured the significance of this venture. Cabeza de Vaca, Estebanico, and the others walked across the continent long before the border between Mexico and the United States came into being. But now the route of their journey is bisected by this national boundary, relegating their story to the fringes of both countries, neither a wholly American story nor a Mexican one. Finally, the story of this extraordinary expedition has become less well known to us simply because the passage of time has rendered Joint Report and Cabeza de Vaca's narrative increasingly difficult to read. Many passages within both texts are downright perplexing to modern readers. Since they were written for 16th century Spaniards, they offer little by way of context. They tell us nothing about how the expedition was conceived, why the leaders became involved in this venture, and what exactly they intended to do upon reaching Florida. Context is even more sorely needed once the expedition lands on the continent and begins interacting with Native Americans. Understanding the Joint Report and the narrative is also complicated by the fact that both are very public and official documents. In casting their narratives, Cabeza de Vaca and the other survivors engaged in self-conscious scripting. They wrote their reports, in part, to establish their virtues and merits and thereby curry royal favor. They thus avoided controversial subjects. For instance, neither source contains a single word about intimate relations between the castaways and native women, even though other evidence suggests that it occurred. Similarly, to avoid problems with the Inquisition, Cabeza de Vaca studiously refrains from using the word miracle to describe his incredible healings. And yet, despite the fact that both documents were shaped in part by the agendas of their authors, they remain extraordinary historical sources. Both are remarkably detailed and complement each other well, except in some minor but significant points. But to fully understand them, one must also resort to scraps of information buried in many other sources, and avail oneself of recent findings on the archaeology, climate, geography, botany, and population history of North America. The most daunting aspect of writing this book has been the quest to locate all sorts of elusive information to help me explain the curious behavior of 16th century Spaniards and their often perplexing interactions with very different native groups. In spite of my best efforts, I am far from having succeeded in every case. I can only say that I have gained an enormous appreciation for the craft of the storyteller. Cabeza de Vaca and his companions were the first outsiders to have lived in the immense territories north of Mexico. Their accounts give us the rarest of glimpses into pre-contact North America. These pioneers were able to see the continent before any other outsiders, prior to European contact. But the lands visited by Cabeza de Vaca and the others were by no means static or pre-lapsarian. North America was changing profoundly and irreversibly even during the half a century since Columbus. The population of the Americas was already declining with startling speed due to epidemic diseases introduced by Europeans. In the course of the 16th century, many indigenous groups disappeared from the face of the earth. Even those who survived had to change beyond recognition or merge with larger groups in order to endure. What the castaways saw and recorded constitutes our very first, and frequently our only, window into a continent before and during this great devastation. They depicted a world that was alive. Wherever the survivors went, they found Native Americans, all vigorously exploiting the environment by setting fires to hunt deer, or replacing large tracts of North American Eden with plots of corn. These groups moved about in deliberate circuits to take advantage of different edible sources, possessed intricate trading networks, and waged war on one another with the same cunning and vindictiveness of their European counterparts. Tantalizingly, the castaways also reported dramatic instances of population decline. America was changing before their very eyes. By the time English, French, and Spanish colonists penned their impressions in the 17th and 18th centuries, the indigenous populations had been greatly diminished, and the flora and fauna had reclaimed the abandoned lands. It is no wonder that such writers were prone to conjuring images of a wild, virgin North America, only sparsely populated by bands of Indians who were themselves primeval and incapable of conquering nature. This perception has endured to the present time, in what one scholar has aptly called the pristine myth of America. In this sense, the castaways offer a much-needed corrective to a seductive but ultimately distorted image. And beyond these insights into pre-Columbian North America, the story of the castaways constitutes an extraordinary instance of first contacts between peoples whose ancestors had remained apart for at least 12,000 years. When these two peoples finally came face to face with one another, they did it from the perspective of vastly different cultures, lifestyles, technologies, and expectations. Yet no matter how outwardly different they appeared from each other, they were still ordinary humans, trying to come to terms with one another as best as they could. Too often, the human dimension of these encounters is lost in the crucible of grand imperial narratives. The script is predictable. Gold-crazed conquistadors confront either savages or unsuspecting exemplars of paradise on earth. The outcome of such encounters is never in doubt. The Odyssey of the Florida survivors reminds us that first contacts were, in fact, far more interesting. Not all voyages of exploration were equal, just as not all Native Americans were the same. Early encounters were intensely personal affairs, guided by the personalities of those involved and resources available to them. The Florida expedition makes this point powerfully. Here are conquerors who were themselves conquered, and Indians who became masters and benefactors, all the while acting in deeply human ways. At its most elemental, the castaway's tale constitutes, in microcosm, the much broader story of how Europeans, Africans, and natives set out to bridge the enormous cultural distances separating them. It is, in essence, the story of America. The journey of Cabeza de Vaca, Estebanico, and the others was thus spiritual as much as physical. Their life depended on their ability to understand the basic humanity of their indigenous masters and hosts. Time and again, as the survivors came within sight of a new native group, they had to find a middle ground. They were European and African by birth, but were becoming American by experience. So profound was the survivors' spiritual journey that fellow conquistadors could scarcely recognize them on the radiant spring day when they finally reemerged from the depths of the continent. Chapter 1. The Prize That Was Snatched Away. The story of Cabeza de Vaca and his companions has its origins in the Caribbean archipelago, that immense arch of green gems set against a turquoise sea that was Spain's first foothold in America. There, at the edge of an unexplored continent, two partners dreamed of ruling a vast and wealthy colony on the mainland. They nearly succeeded. But a heartless betrayal caused their venture to unravel in the end. The Florida expedition was a direct consequence of this failure. It was a second and even more desperate bid for a continental possession and a last-ditch effort to remake a life. The older and more influential of the two partners was Diego Velázquez, a widower, beloved for his banter and constant talk of pleasure and mischief. During his long career as a colonist in the Caribbean, he had witnessed a good deal of human misery. But he also liked to laugh, and often found himself surrounded by eager listeners. He had taken his chances by accompanying Columbus on his second voyage in 1493, and by staying on a godforsaken island that turned out to contain the largest gold deposits anywhere on those islands. Velázquez was also resourceful at waging war and getting the vanquished natives to work in his mines. In a little more than a decade, he emerged as the richest resident of Española, the island shared today by Haiti and the Dominican Republic. Yet more than his gold, Velázquez's network of allies and acquaintances constituted his greatest asset. From Española, a wave of conquests radiated in all directions. So Velázquez summoned his influence within the imperial bureaucracy, and relied upon his contacts at the Spanish court to secure colonization rights. His playful demeanor belied great ambition. By 1511, he had obtained the crown's authorization to occupy Cuba, the largest island of the archipelago, and potentially even richer than Española. The conquest of Cuba would require much help, so Velázquez sought out the kind of men who could make this undertaking a reality. Most crucially, he struck up a partnership with a fierce-looking adventurer named Panfilo de Narváez. The two men got along well from the start. They hailed from nearby towns in Spain's central plateau and complemented each other admirably. Velázquez may have been well-connected, but he was getting old, and his expanding waistline was already the butt of jokes. Narváez, by contrast, was still in his 30s and looked every bit the part of the Spanish conquistador. Tall and muscular, with light hair turning to red, a ruddy beard, and a deep booming voice, as if it came from a vault. The genial administrator and the intrepid adventurer imposed their will on Cuba rapidly, leaving no doubt that their alliance worked well. Velázquez wrote letters to the king and prudently surveyed the southern coast with a fleet of canoes. Meanwhile, Narváez cut an east-west swath right through the middle of Cuba at the head of 100 Europeans and perhaps 1,000 Indian porters. In just 4 years, the band of outsiders crushed all native resistance, turning a lush island into a sordid outfitting station and a brave new colonial experiment. Buoyed by their success, the two partners felt sufficiently confident to set their sights even higher. For a time, the possibilities seemed unlimited. Using Cuba as a base, Velázquez ventured farther west. Early in 1517, he dispatched an expedition that drifted onto the Yucatan Peninsula, probably blown off course and not intending to go so far. What the Christian sailors saw there astonished them. Large temples made of stone and mortar. Indian nobles adorned with extravagant headdresses. Exquisitely designed ornaments of gold and silver. They had come in contact with the Maya. They also brought back to Cuba two natives from Yucatan, old Melchor and little Julian, who were able to elaborate on first impressions. Velázquez, ordinarily a man of steely patience, seems to have been overcome with excitement. He hastily cobbled together a second expedition, which departed in January 1518 under the command of Velázquez's nephew, Juan de Grijalva. The spring and summer months of 1518 seemed interminable for Velázquez as he waited for word from his relative. At last in the fall, the second exploratory party returned to Cuba carrying precious objects obtained by barter with the Indians of Yucatan. In their possession was gold, valued at between 16,000 and 20,000 pesos, considerably more than what the Spaniards had been able to extract from Cuba in an entire year. The stuff that made dreams of El Dorado seem all too real. But Diego Velázquez was now in a bind. Although faced with a colossal opportunity, he had exhausted his financial resources by launching two expeditions in two consecutive years. He could not wait too long to launch yet another expedition, for rumors of the wealth of Yucatan were already reaching the ears of potential competitors. The plump master of Cuba desperately needed to find a partner, someone who would captain a third fleet to claim these new lands for the greater glory of Spain and for his own. There is little doubt that Velázquez's first choice would have been Panfilo de Narváez, his old partner and trusted right-hand man. But alas, Narváez was in Spain at the time, serving as a representative of the island of Cuba at court. Within Cuba itself, there were very few settlers wealthy enough for a venture of this magnitude. So, in spite of some misgivings, Velázquez decided to send Hernán Cortés. Cortés was one of the original conquerors of Cuba. He was vivacious, likable, and literate. He could even pepper his speech with Latin. Velázquez promptly recognized these qualities and made Cortés his personal secretary in 1512 or 1513. For several months, Cortés acted as Velázquez's confidant and most trusted representative in matters that required diplomacy and tact. But the two men had a falling out. It appears that Cortés began to chafe under Velázquez's command. In 1514, Cortés, ever the man of action, tried to make his way back to Española, bearing a load of letters that detailed Velázquez's abuses for members of the Audiencia of Santo Domingo, a high court with jurisdiction over Cuba. As fate would have it, Cortés was seized before leaving Cuba. At first, Velázquez wanted to have his secretary hanged, but with the passing of time, and after many residents interceded on Cortes's behalf, his rage subsided. Eventually Velázquez relented and turned Cortes loose, but refused to restore him as secretary. For Cortes it was a defining moment. From then on he did his utmost to regain Velázquez's trust, behaving so humbly and seeking to please even the lowliest of Velázquez's servants. In this, he had some success. Cortes asked Velázquez to be a godfather witness in his wedding. The two men became compadres. When Cortes learned of Velázquez's proposal to jointly explore Yucatán, it must have seemed to him like the culmination of a long and arduous process of social rehabilitation. At the threshold of a new phase in his life, Cortes seized his destiny like a possessed man. He talked to friends and neighbors, bought a caravel and a brigantine, and used his formidable powers of persuasion to procure wine, oil, beans, and chickpeas on credit. But as the months of preparation wore on, Velázquez began to worry over Cortés's independence of character. At the 11th hour, he attempted to relieve his old secretary of command. By then, however, Cortés was too deeply involved to be stopped. In the early hours of November 18th, 1518, he gathered his ships, crews, and soldiers and left Cuba in haste. When Velázquez was notified that Cortés had taken to sea, he hurried to the shore at daybreak. With Velázquez beckoning to him, Cortés got on a small boat and rowed within earshot. Velázquez reportedly shouted to him, "Why, compadre, are you going so? Is this a good way to say farewell to me?" Cortes could barely respond. It was not an auspicious beginning to the expedition. Velázquez, the great leader of Cuba, the astute administrator who still claimed powerful backers at all levels of the imperial bureaucracy, would seek his revenge. He would eventually launch a fourth armada, larger and better supplied than the previous three, to extend his authority over the mainland and bring back the outlaw Cortes, in chains, if necessary. This time, he would entrust the task to his old partner, Pánfilo de Narváez. By the time Cortés took to the sea, leaving Velázquez shouting from the shore, Narváez had been absent from Cuba for 3 years. He had spent this time in Spain, following the court. It should have been a pleasurable tour of duty, a welcome respite from the rustic new world. Instead, it turned into a hellish experience. Narváez had traveled to Spain to act as Diego Velázquez's representative at court and secure some privileges for his fellow European settlers in Cuba. Narváez had plans for himself as well. Being already at court and at great expense, he intended to get the king's permission to lead an expedition, either to present-day Colombia or to Central America. Yet Narváez never quite made himself at home at the court. He found many reasons to complain, beginning with the transient lifestyle. The Spanish court in the 16th century was perpetually on the move. It resembled a roving circus of eccentrics, traveling at times on dignified ships and carriages, but more often than not on donkeys or by foot on dusty roads. The king's duties took him everywhere, and his unceasing wandering exacted a heavy price on those forced to follow him. When the court resided in sizable cities, the logistics were straightforward, but numerous problems arose when it passed through small towns. For instance, a man at court had to give out generous tips to the aposentadores, the court officials charged with making the lodging arrangements. In the absence of such a bribe, the courtier was liable to wind up in a bleak inn far from the ear of the king and his ministers. It was only the first of a great many expenses. The courtier was responsible for paying a veritable army of service providers, butchers, bakers, and winemakers for supplies, woodcutters for fuel to stay warm, shoemakers and tailors for elegant clothing, doormen who controlled access to the king, royal servants who eased matters in his presence, secretaries who controlled the pace of the business being transacted, and so forth. None of this came cheaply. Bishop Antonio de Guevara, a seasoned courtier and author of a how-to manual for those wishing to join the court, put it very eloquently. Where the court resides, nothing is sold, and everything is resold. In addition to money, a petitioner like Narváez needed a thick skin. Individuals wishing to join the court were subjected to constant scrutiny and mockery. They could be ridiculed for dressing too extravagantly or too plainly, for being too eager to get on with their business, or too timid and roundabout in approach, or for lacking proper manners or affecting manners above their station. The hapless courtier could only smile at such humiliation and turn the other cheek. One angry word was enough to jeopardize his painstaking lobbying effort. Courtiers spent their nights devising schemes to approach this or that minister, and their days solving the innumerable problems posed by an extravagant lifestyle on the trail. It went on for months at a time, driving all but the most determined men to desperation. A nobleman who left his family, believing that he would be back in 2 months, quite frequently spent 6 at court without obtaining any appreciable results, other than having wasted a good portion of his estate. Shrewdly, Narváez and his companions began to lobby for favors by delivering to the monarch the first large consignment of Cuban gold, totaling 12,437 pesos. Nothing could have been more persuasive to King Ferdinand than the promise of similar remittances in the future. The Cuban delegation also enjoyed the support of some influential court members, chief among them the Bishop of Burgos, Juan Rodriguez de Fonseca. The good bishop was a mercurial man of striking contrasts worthy of a novel. Although a man of God, he was exceedingly savvy in worldly affairs. Bishop Rodriguez de Fonseca had helped to organize Columbus's second voyage and had made a career out of mustering armadas, an occupation more suitable for ruffians than bishops, as one contemporary insightfully noted. The bishop also happened to preside over the royal committee that administered all of Spain's New World possessions, the powerful Council of the Indies. He ran the council from the comfort of his home, and as he saw fit. As it turned out, this influential figure was notoriously, even scandalously, partial toward Diego Velázquez. It was rumored that the bishop wanted to marry one of his spinster nieces, Mayor de Fonseca, to Velázquez, a widower whose previous marriage had lasted barely a week. It was also said that Velázquez, in return, had granted a substantial stake of Indian servants from Cuba to the bishop. Whether all the rumors were true, Narváez could expect to be warmly received by Rodriguez de Fonseca. Narváez's lobbying campaign could have succeeded, if not for two extraordinary and unforeseen complications. The first was the death of King Ferdinand. Just as Narváez was getting settled at court as it traveled through western Spain, Ferdinand fell seriously ill and promptly died in late January 1516. The court was thrown into disarray, and all negotiations had to be suspended. The king's death must have impressed Narváez profoundly. Ferdinand's long and portentous reign, first jointly with Queen Isabella, had spanned Narváez's entire life. During that time, Spaniards had lived through their most heroic and hopeful days, as the Catholic monarchs unified their realms, drove the last Muslim enclaves out of the Iberian Peninsula, and sponsored the expedition of an obscure Genoese that culminated in the discovery of America. In 5 decades, Ferdinand and Isabel had managed to parlay a collection of disheveled kingdoms at the tip of Europe into the most promising empire in the world. Yet for all their successes, the Catholic monarchs had failed to prepare an orderly succession. By 1516, Ferdinand's most direct heir was his daughter, Juana, a woman who had remained secluded in the castle of Tordesillas in central Spain for 7 years. She refused to bathe or change her clothes and would not eat in the presence of others. Her behavior was so erratic and contrary to prescribed royal protocol that she became known to history as Juana the Mad. This condition was brought about, or at least exacerbated, by her tumultuous marriage to Philip the Fair, an archduke of the Low Countries who enjoyed the company of other women. Juana's possessiveness and jealousy lingered even after Philip's death in 1506. Some accounts state that Juana had her husband's coffin repeatedly opened to make sure that the body had not been snatched away, and describe how she knelt down and kissed Philip's feet immediately after the shrouds were removed. After Juana, the next in line of succession was her eldest son, Charles. At the time of Ferdinand's death, Charles was still a gangly 16-year-old, born and raised in the city of Ghent in Belgium. He was quiet, indolent, somewhat awkward, and very much the tool of his ambitious Flemish advisors. In the eyes of many Spaniards, Charles of Ghent represented a foreign intrusion, as he did not even speak Spanish. But the mental condition of his mother thrust him onto the throne, and he took it. After bidding adieu to the Flemish estates in July 1517, Charles and his entourage journeyed first to Tordesillas to obtain the endorsement of Queen Juana, and then around Spain to meet his new subjects. For Narváez, the unfolding of this stately drama only resulted in delays, as months of waiting turned into years. In the meantime, he had to contend with a second unforeseen complication. One day in late 1515, a friar by the name of Bartolomé de las Casas joined the court. Las Casas had been Narváez's chaplain during the conquest of Cuba, but now he was a much changed man. Friar Las Casas had experienced an epiphany that would propel him to devote the rest of his life to the passionate defense of the natives of America. According to his own account, this flash of moral insight occurred when he was preparing a sermon to celebrate Pentecost in 1514. While perusing the Ecclesiasticus, he stumbled on these words: "The bread of the needy is their life. He who defrauds him thereof is a man of blood. He who takes away his neighbor's living slays him, and he who defrauds the laborer of his hire is a blood shedder." Las Casas began his remarkable transmutation by returning to Diego Velázquez the Indians that had been apportioned to him as reward. Within months, Las Casas became notorious throughout Cuba for preaching that God intended the natives to be free. More threateningly still, he took to warning his fellow Europeans that enslaving Indians or reducing them to servitude constituted a mortal sin. From Cuba, the embattled priest took his crusade to the Spanish court, where he found many sympathetic ears. He aired his views and regaled court members with horrific stories of New World ruthlessness and uncontrolled greed. Narváez's exploits figured prominently among them. In 1516, Las Casas introduced three memoriales, formal petitions or requests, detailing various atrocities perpetrated against the Indians in Cuba and elsewhere in the Caribbean. Narváez was forced to respond, disputing some of Las Casas's claims and stating that his former chaplain was an irresponsible man of little authority and credibility who speaks of things that he did not see. Still, the reformist movement at first succeeded so well that it not only put Narváez on the defensive, but also undermined the power of Bishop Rodríguez de Fonseca, a principal backer of Cuba's conquerors and chief proponent of a system that was based on the exploitation of Indian labor. Las Casas pressed ahead with his campaign. His solution to the Indian problem was both disarmingly simple and extremely radical. The Indians need to be placed beyond the grasp of the Spaniards, because no remedy that leaves them in Spanish hands will stop their annihilation. He further explained that the Spaniards already living in the New World, who would be unable to sustain themselves, had to be helped to make a living without committing sin and on the basis of their own industry. A group of Indian holders and representatives from the Indies, that included Narvaez, resolutely opposed the movement to set the Indians free, dryly claiming that the Indians do not have the capacity to remain by themselves, and warning that any effort to deprive New World colonists of Indians would constitute a serious breach of the terms under which they had agreed to go to the new lands. The quarrel reflected a long-smoldering controversy within the empire that would continue to rage for decades. Las Casas would go on to publish a brief but incendiary treatise in 1552, entitled The Devastation of the Indies, that would expose Spain's abuses and establish its reputation as a cruel colonial power around the world. Yet from Narvaez's perspective, the battle over the treatment of the Indians constituted an unfortunate distraction. By the beginning of 1518, he had little to show for a stay of more than 2 years in Europe. It was the news of Diego Velázquez's discoveries in the Yucatán Peninsula that finally brought an end to Narvaez's frustrating sojourn in the Old World. Reports of Velázquez's discoveries reached the court in late 1517 or early 1518, changing completely the nature of Narvaez's embassy. His most pressing concern now was to help Velázquez secure the administration of these new lands. In a matter of months, his efforts bore fruit, perhaps owing to the excitement over the discoveries or to the influence of Bishop Rodríguez de Fonseca, who was able to reassert his power in the nascent administration of King Charles. Narvaez got most of what he wanted. In November 1518, the king named Velázquez Adelantado, civilian authority of Yucatán, and appointed Narvaez as contador, controller. The king also ordered that Narvaez be paid his full salary as an advocate of Cuba for the entire period that he had spent in Spain, surely a most welcome relief. King Charles even took the time to write to Diego Velázquez, praising Narvaez for his services and recommending him highly. Thus, Narvaez ended his torturous experience in the Spanish court on a high note, a fact that would weigh heavily on his future plans. In early 1519, Narvaez returned to Cuba. He arrived just a few weeks after Hernán Cortés had brashly made off with the ships, which raised questions about the fate of the Yucatán that Narvaez had just secured for Velázquez. Remarkably, Velázquez had not immediately appreciated the extent of Cortés's treachery and the seriousness of his challenge. In complete control of Cuba, and now also secure in his lifetime appointment as Adelantado of Yucatán, he could scarcely imagine that a servant, un criado, with no court backing to speak of, could turn into a serious rival. Certainly Cortés had left in a hurry, but he had done so out of fear that he would be relieved of the command of the expedition to Mexico. Velázquez still hoped that Cortés would act as his agent. Indeed, from November 1518, when Cortés left, to August 1519, Velázquez was content to wait for news from his spirited envoy. He even sent additional supplies. Cortés did not waste his time during these months. His fleet first sailed west toward the Yucatán Peninsula and then coasted along the Gulf of Mexico, finally stopping in San Juan de Ulúa, a little island in close proximity to the mainland with a good harbor. There Cortés and his men came in contact with the most powerful indigenous kingdom on the continent. They learned that the center of this fabulous empire, the city-state of México Tenochtitlan, lay not on the coast, but 200 miles inland on a high plateau, and that its ruler was a magnificent lord named Moctezuma. Thus began an epic exchange conducted with runners, couriers, and spies. Cortés explained to Moctezuma's emissaries, from a relentlessly European perspective that must have surely mystified them, that King Charles, ruler of the largest part of the world, had sent him to pay his respects, that he and his men intended to begin their ascent toward Mexico Tenochtitlan and that they wanted an audience with the powerful Moctezuma. Moctezuma's first impulse was to avoid contact with these odd strangers. He lavished presents on the Spaniards instead, carried by as many as 100 porters, hoping to induce them to return contentedly to wherever they had come from. Little did Moctezuma know that his extraordinary gifts, far from dissuading Cortes and his men, only fanned the flames of their greed. The Spaniards were delighted to receive several gold samples that were the size of garbanzo beans and lentils, necklaces of jade set in gold, golden bells, scepters studded with precious stones, gold rings, a room full of breastplates and shields of gold and silver, human figurines of jugglers, dancers, and hunchbacks, statues in solid gold of jaguars, monkeys, and armadillos, 2 wooden discs as large as carriage wheels, one covered with gold and the other one with silver, many cotton blankets and cloaks with intricate chest-like patterns of white, black, and yellow, magnificent headdresses of large and shiny feathers unknown in Europe, and 2 screenfold books or codices made of bark and containing stylized drawings of humans and animals. It was a treasure trove that easily dwarfed anything that had been previously found in the New World. Cortes decided to use these astonishing riches to open a direct line of communication with the King of Spain. From the coast of Mexico, Cortes dispatched a ship that was to skip Cuba entirely and go to Spain, avoiding the most common sailing routes. In addition to the treasure, the ship transported 2 representatives from Cortes, whose charge was to negotiate directly with King Charles, circumventing Velázquez's authority. Although the plan was to sail on to Spain, the vessel ultimately touched on Cuba in August 1519. One of Cortes's agents, Francisco de Montejo, suggested a brief landfall at his estancia in northwestern Cuba to take on some provisions before crossing the Atlantic. At least one startled resident was allowed to go on board and gaze at the Indian objects and hear some of the stories about the Aztecs and their lord Moctezuma. Although the witness had been sworn to secrecy, he revealed that the booty on the ship was so enormous that there was no other ballast than gold. Velázquez became livid when he learned of Cortés's treachery. He immediately sent 2 ships in hot pursuit to seize the treasure on the high seas, or at least warn Spanish authorities of Cortés's fraud and request that the objects be confiscated. Velázquez and Narváez also vowed to stop Cortés and press their claim on a land that promised fabulous wealth. No resources were spared. With the 2 most powerful men on the island working side by side, an armada of 18 ships, 80 horses, and more than 1,000 men and a few women was assembled by early 1520. The armada was roughly twice as large as that of Cortes. So many Europeans became involved in this expedition, and so few would remain in Cuba, that the island would become vulnerable to being reclaimed by the Indians. Velázquez considered leading the expedition to Mexico himself, but he was already too old, and, as some playfully observed, too fat for such an undertaking. Narváez would lead it. He must have relished the staggering stakes involved. In uncharted lands, Narváez and his men would face not one, but 2 enemies, a renegade band of Europeans, and the most powerful indigenous polity in the hemisphere, possibly making common cause with each other. Yet Narváez remained confident. In the presence of Velázquez, he boastfully declared that even with half as many people, I am certain to imprison Cortés so you can do with him as you please. When the time comes, I will know how to treat Cortés. He will respect me and come back as a son, and I will send him to you so he'll never raise his head again. Narváez's overconfidence would resurface again and again in the course of his life, at last with tragic results. By February of 1520, Narvaez and his fleet were prepared to leave Cuba. However, before the army could sail, Velazquez and Narvaez had to deal with one last nettlesome bureaucratic affair. Authorities in Española had gotten word of the brewing conflict between Velazquez and Cortés, and the likelihood of a civil war among Spaniards in Mexico had them worried. Wishing to prevent the spilling of blood among brothers in the new lands, a most disastrous precedent, the Audiencia of Santo Domingo hurriedly dispatched one of its own as a mediator, the licenciado Lucas Vázquez de Ayón. Sailing on two ships put at his disposal, this resourceful 50-year-old man met both Narvaez and Velázquez and did his best to dissuade them from their plan of direct confrontation. Instead of initiating hostilities, the licenciado reasoned, Velázquez and Narvaez would gain more by simply sending two or three ships with provisions for Cortés, along with some discreet agents who could find out more about his intentions and remind him of his duties and royal orders. More menacingly, the licenciado Vázquez de Ayón notified Narvaez that he would face a penalty of 50,000 ducats if he insisted on taking his armada to Mexico. The proud conquerors of Cuba refused to recognize the authority of the Audiencia of Santo Domingo and, undaunted, proceeded with their preparations. The licenciado made arrangements of his own to follow Narvaez to Mexico, where he would continue his mediating role. Narvaez's fleet, including the licenciado's two ships, first crossed the Straits of Yucatan in March 1520. Following Cortés's route, the expedition continued along the Gulf Coast of Mexico, skirting the modern states of Campeche, Tabasco, and Veracruz. The Gulf is a relatively small and self-contained body of water, but sailing it can be treacherous. During the winter months, the Gulf is buffeted by a series of polar air masses known as northers. These unstable fronts of cold air come down from Alaska, barreling through North America, and descend on the Gulf's warm waters, producing gusty winds and pouring rain that can last for days at a time. They seem to materialize out of nowhere and hit with great force. Although the northern season lasts from October to March, it is possible to get caught in one even in the spring. Near Veracruz, Narvaez's difficulties began when a norther caught up with them in early April as they sailed under the shadow of the Sierra de San Martin. One ship capsized, six others were damaged, and 40 men drowned. It was the first recorded shipwreck in the Gulf of Mexico. Narvaez's problems would only continue. Wishing to spare 60 ailing men, as well as all of the women on board, from the impending showdown with Cortés, Narvaez put them ashore at the Rio de Alvarado, where the armada had briefly paused to reassemble. The sick men and the women were to remain as guests of the indigenous people of Tuxtepec until Narvaez could assess the level of danger the mission faced. Unfortunately, the group left behind outlived its welcome and was massacred by the hosts some weeks later. The rest of the fleet was able to reach San Juan de Ulua in late April 1520. Some of the ships were badly in need of repairs. Aztec lookouts on the coast promptly spotted the Spanish armada. They made a drawing on a cloth of 18 vessels, five of them wrecked on the beach, and sent it to Moctezuma with fast runners. It did not take long before Narvaez and Moctezuma were exchanging messages. Narvaez sent word that he had come to Mexico to apprehend Cortés and his soldiers, who were bad men, with no license from the King of Spain, and that after capturing Cortés, they would all go back to Castile. Encouragingly, Moctezuma confirmed that Cortés was in Mexico Tenochtitlan, and, as he had done earlier, showered Narvaez with valuable presents. Evidently, the Aztec leader was playing the two sides against each other. Having learned of Cortés's whereabouts, Narvaez disembarked his men and horses and established a permanent settlement on the mainland. The veteran captain conducted a formal ceremony of possession, an act that must have seemed to him like the culmination of his lobbying efforts in Spain. He then founded the town of San Salvador, probably where the modern city of Veracruz now stands. In a matter of weeks, San Salvador grew into a substantial settlement of some 80 or 90 houses surrounding a plaza, a church, and a jail. It also boasted city officials and magistrates appointed by Narváez, but whose authority derived ultimately from the King of Spain himself. Although peaceful on the surface, the small settlement was divided against itself. Certainly there were those who supported the Velázquez-Narváez faction, but many others in the expedition were either indifferent or sympathetic toward Cortés. Some of the rank and file, for instance, had consented to go to Mexico only under duress, as Velázquez's vigorous recruiting in Cuba had involved strong-arm tactics and veiled or explicit threats. After weathering a severe storm, these reluctant volunteers had little appetite for battling a group of fellow Europeans just to settle a personal score in which they had no stake. Others were less loyal still. A group of hardened adventurers who enlisted merely as a means of leaving Cuba and reaching the new world of gold that they had heard so much about. Far from wanting to antagonize Cortés, these pragmatists were more inclined to join him to secure a place at the victor's table when the spoils were distributed. And into this combustible mix, the licenciado Vázquez de Ayón and his staff had inserted themselves. Here was a royal judge from Española who had opposed Narváez's enterprise all along, and who had objected to the decision to disembark the men and found San Salvador on the grounds that it would upset the neighboring Indians. Worse still, Vázquez de Ayón was gaining a following among expedition members who wished to avoid a clash. When Narváez's determination to deal harshly with Cortés became clear, the licenciado and his followers turned defiant. Narváez